Blog Talk Radio.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for calling in and listening. You can reach me at Twitter, at Joy Keyes, or on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. And you can also check me out on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keyes. I'd love to hear from you, so you can email me, saturdayswithjoykeyes@hotmail.com. Thank you so much. I was on a bit of a hiatus, and I still saw people were listening. I really appreciate your support, and we have a lot of exciting shows coming up today, but also in the future. So please continue to listen in and learn some new things about books and people and ways to improve your life. This morning, I have a wonderful author. She has been on the show before. She's a Nigerian author. She's a professor. She's written four novels. She has won $100,000 in the Nigerian literature contest. She was a judge on the Man Booker Prize contest. And now I have her on today for her book, Better Never Than Late. Say that like three times, Better Never Than Late. Like, I think I wrote it wrong a couple times. I had to go back and was like, wait, Better Never Than Late. So good morning, Utu. To Oma, right?
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. And I should say Anya E. That means like long time no see, yeah?
Anya E, yes. Anya E, then I should answer Anya E, yeah.
See, you got me. You got to speak slowly.
So, Anya
I know Odima. Odima, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Just to let the audience know, Chika is Igbo from Nigeria, and I was speaking to her in Little Igbo just as a form of respect. You know, it's nice. I think people appreciate when you try to learn about their cultures and their languages, so I try to do that for the different artists I have come on. But good morning in English again, Chika. So just for people who don't know you, why did you become a writer? Why not a policeman? Why not a lawyer? Why not a doctor? I mean, artists, they don't make any money. What are you going to do,
Why did I become a writer? I think that writing chooses you, you know. I always wanted to write. I mean, for as long as I can remember, it was the one thing that I always wanted to do. No matter what else I wanted to be, I wanted to be a diplomat. I wanted to travel the world. I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. It was just a sort of my way of dealing with, you know, with the world. I always took to pen and paper. So as a kid, I'd write poetry. I wrote poetry a lot up until college. And then I realized that I was a really bad poet, and I gave that up. I write really crappy poems. So now, I mean, I'll still do poetry once in a while, but I have enough self-awareness to know that they are crappy and that I'll never make a good poet.
Oh, wow. Okay, but I'll tell you, you are a good writer, and
thank you.
Many other people have realized that. I'm glad that you continue to write. And your books deal with women. The books that I've read, they deal with a lot of women. You did write more of a historical, fictional type of book, but On Black Sister Streets, dealing with women, Night Dancer, dealing with women, and this current book, Better Never Than Late. I think it's a little more, you have some of the men's stories in there, but you still have a lot of women. Why is that?
I think I'm very drawn to the stories of women. I'm also very drawn to the stories of people at the margins. I'm very often in our societies. you know, it is still women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are sort of stories that I'm very drawn to women's stories, particularly women whose stories leave a lot of gaps for us to fill in. So at the moment, I'm just finishing a novella about Joanna Vassa, and Joanna Vassa was the daughter of Oluwade Ekuyanu or Gustavus Vassa. And Oluwade Ekuyanu, for those who don't know, Elias Gustavus Vassa, was a Nigerian slave. He was born around 1745, and he was kidnapped when he was 10 or 12 years old and brought to the Americas. And he was very hardworking. He eventually bought his freedom. He paid £40 that he was bought for to his last master, who told him, "Well, if you earn £40 and you pay me by then, I'll set you free." And £40 in those days was a whole lot of money. And so he did that. But he loved England a lot, so he moved back to the UK. He did a lot of things. He worked after he bought his freedom, he worked as a slave master, as an overseer on a plantation, and then became an abolitionist, right? And then he moved to England, was very active in the abolitionist movement, and married a white English woman, Susanna Collins, and then had two daughters, I think Maria and Joanna. And so the novella I'm finishing now is about Joanna's life, the daughter, and her story, you know, sort of leaves a lot of gaps. I'm very drawn to stories of women. That was a very long
I think
way
that's good.
Going back to my original point of why I write about women a lot.
No, I think it's important to also say that you're not just writing about all good women. You show the characters have different sides to them. And so at one chapter, we're like, oh, this poor person. The next chapter, we're like, oh, my God, I hate them. Get rid of them. Why are they there? You know, go somewhere.
Yeah.
You surprise us, you know, with these twists, and as well as the men. And then also you have the quote-unquote evil characters, and you're persuading them. And then you're like, oh, they're helping the community. They want their daughters to grow nice and, you know, intelligent.
Yeah.
They won't cheat or rape the other guy's wife. And you're like, damn, I was hating this guy, and now I kind of like him, you know?
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you decide that as a writer to make them that complimentary type of person? How do you decide that?
Well, first of all, thanks for that. I think it's a huge compliment to sort of understand that the characters have nuances. Because I think that's how we are as human beings, right? We have a lot of, you know, nuances. We're not all good and we're not all bad. I mean, arguably, I can think of two people at this moment who are terribly bad, and I don't even want to see their redeeming qualities if they have that at all, right? So one of the things I tell my students is that for every character, especially for your protagonists, because for, you know, the minor characters, you know, they can be flat, that's fine. But for your protagonists, try to have their backstories, even if you don't use those backstories in your story, right? But try to know everything about these characters, you know, because if you know their backstories, then you know their motives. And if you know their motives, then you're better able to write them, even if those backstories are not in the light of day. And so I also try to do that for myself. So I try to know the backstories of all my protagonists so that even when they're all bad, there is sort of logic to that badness, if that makes any sense. So you're not excusing their badness. One of the things that you have to do as a writer is to try to get into the shoes of all of your characters, the good and the bad, right? Because if you don't, then you run the risk of writing very one-sided characters. And when you write characters that are, you know, one-dimensional, readers know, and there's no fun, you know, and there's no challenge in writing those characters as well. Yeah. Just sort of being aware that as human beings, we're complex and there are nuances to us, and that those nuances should also be visible in the characters that we create, so that readers are better able to, even if you don't like those characters or understand those characters, but accept them as human, right? So to sort of humanize the characters that you write,
Well, some of the issues that you deal with in this book and in other books that you've written are immigration. According to the IOM 2015, over a million migrants and refugees came from Africa to Europe. In this book, you have several couples dealing with this issue of coming from Africa and coming over to Belgium. Now, one of the interesting things is we talked right before this show started was desperation, you know, the issue of desperation. Talk to us about that and how that developed. From your real life, you might have seen things because you yourself came from Africa to a European country and then people around you.
I think that desperation and a certain type of living home, you know, go hand in hand, right? I mean, for me, it was very different. I left Nigeria very willingly because I fell in love with a man, you know, for whom Nigeria wasn't home and he was going to go home, and I went with him. But even having chosen to go with him because of love, I also left with a lot of anxiety because I think that migration and anxiety also go hand in hand, right? You're leaving the familiar, you're leaving your home for somewhere, you know, where you have to sometimes start from the very beginning, like I had to in Belgium. I left, you know, to go to a place where nothing I knew before mattered, you know, not the cultural etiquette, not the language, you know, so I had to start from the very beginning. And then for some of the people in Better Never Than Late, and for some of these, you know, migrants, for want of a better word, that we sort of hear about drowning, you know, trying to cross over to go to Europe from Africa, I think that you have to be very desperate, right, to leave, not knowing where you're going to, not knowing how you're going to end up, not having any network, any support network waiting for you when you get there. And also, haven't heard the stories of people who have died trying to get to the same destination that you're trying to get to. So it's a level of desperation that I feel that if more people were aware of it, or if more people thought of it, especially people in the host countries, that the rhetoric around migration would be tempered with a lot of compassion and kindness, right? So at the moment, I think a lot of rhetoric that sort of deals or thinks of these people as people who just wake up, okay, I'm going to leave, say, Nigeria, and go through Libya and go through Spain or go through wherever, end up in Italy, end up in England, end up in America, just so I can come here and live on welfare, live off welfare, right? And that is such a one-sided, very cruel, very inhumane.
Well, they're coming from a point of fear. I think that rhetoric is coming from a point of fear, because here in America we have the issue of the other. And for us, the other are people coming from Latin America, you know, Mexico, coming from, you know, Muslim countries, and supposedly coming over here to take all of our resources. Our taxes are being paid to take care of them and their families, or they're going to hurt us, hurt our women. So here we have all of this. And those people also had to maybe walk long ways, had to boat long ways, had to leave families behind. So they're the only ones that come up here. And then they get tricked sometimes. They come up here and they get tricked. So then they're like stuck, you know?
But there's also a lot of ignorance as well, you know. And there's also, so there's the fear for me rooted in ignorance, but there is also the fear that politicians who ought to know better, or who know better, propagate, right?
Yes.
So that they can they can win votes, and they propagate that, they exploit that ignorance to create a fear that they know shouldn't be there, you know. So, which is why their rhetoric lacks the sort of compassion that they ought to have, because they know these things, you know. So when the politician says, well, you know, the Mexicans are coming here to rape our women and to do whatever, they know that that is not true, because they're using these same, you know, undocumented workers, you know, in their casinos and in their, you know, they're using them to, you know, so...
Well, you know, in America, we have, you know, the people. Sorry, say that again.
No, I said, but you know, they're very willingly cultivating and exploiting that fear and the ignorance of their base followers because it benefits them, and because they're also cruel, because you have to be a very cruel person to know that this isn't true and then to exploit that fear, knowing what the consequences might be, you know.
Right. One of the things I talked to you earlier is about how we love and hate your characters. And one of the characters in this book, as well as in your previous book, is the trafficker.
Mm-hmm.
I think the guy's name is Shylock in this one. And at first we hate him, you know. And then like I find out that, you know, he's the only one you can leave the wife with. You know, so the Nigerian man comes up, he leaves his African wife with this trafficker, and they're complete trust, because that's the only way he can keep his business going. And that's a very interesting twist. But the issue of that, going back to immigration, I want to connect that to the issue of classism. We deal with classism a lot in your books, and one of the ways particularly is the issue of maids. And not just the migrants becoming maids who have degrees, PhDs, whatever, but when they were home in Nigeria, they too had maids. So can you talk to the audience a little bit about that culture in Nigeria and having maids and housekeepers and things like that?
I'm always very careful when I talk about this outside of Nigeria, because in Nigeria we understand that you don't have to be particularly wealthy or middle class to have domestic help, right? Because it is also, there's this sort of system where that if you have a roof over your head and you can afford to feed somebody else, that you take that person in, you know, and then that person works for you in exchange for, you know, for a roof over their own head, right? So you find people who you'd consider poor also having mates, right? And the expectation is, okay, because you can do this, you know, you're helping somebody, you're helping somebody else out. So the language is couched, you know, very differently, right? But then on the other hand, you also have people who, you know, who are very wealthy, who can live very well, who have mates, but who do not treat those mates as well as they should, or as well as their resources, you know, allow them to. So I have, I remember a friend telling me the story of going back to Nigeria and going to visit a friend of hers, who, you know, very nice person, very kind person, you know, does all the charity works, whatever. But then their house up, their maid sleeps in the kitchen. So this girl sleeps in the kitchen in front of the fridge. Because of course, this her friend thought that if he were to let that girl sleep on a proper bed, she would get ideas beyond her station, right? So that story bothered me a lot, right?
You bring that up in the book.
So
your character brings that up because she becomes a maid, and then she thinks about, I had a maid, and I never paid my maid.
Precisely, yes, yeah, you know. And so because my character is now in that position where she's now working for somebody else, she's better able to empathize with the people that she thought she was treating well, quote unquote, you know, when she was in Nigeria and was their boss, and, you know, and she was their, she was treating her mate well, and she had to be in a position where she was now a domestic help to realize, you know, I wasn't really treating those people as well as I should have. Normalized, you know, it's normalized that you eat before your mate eats. It's normalized that, you know, the little girl who's looking after your baby doesn't eat the same food as your baby does, you know, or as your children do. It's normalized that, you know, you give your children meat and then you give her the skin to eat, because that's how everybody else treats their people, you know, treats their mates. It's the same thing that we also find, you know, around the language of how refugees and immigrants are treated, right? When something becomes normalized, you stop asking questions and you just sort of go with the flow. So when you're benefiting from a system, is very often that you start asking questions of that system and just go with the flow. No, this is the way everybody does it, you know. And I have these conversations and arguments with people sometimes who say, well, you know, if you treat them any differently, then they'll start behaving. They won't behave anymore. You know, they won't behave as well as they should, right?
Right,
I still go to Nigeria very often. And one of the things that bothers me when I go to Nigeria, for example, is how somebody would come with their driver to visit you, for example, right? And, you know, and the sun is shining outside, and they're sitting inside with you in an air-conditioned house, and you're, you know, talking for hours. And then you go, oh, you know, how did you come? Oh, my driver brought me. Where's the driver? Oh, he's outside, you know?
In the burning heat.
Oh, my God. In the burning heat, right? But it's so normalized that that person telling you this, who does a lot of charity work, right, doesn't think anything of it, that this driver is outside in the heat, right? And it's not just one person, it's not two people, it's not three people. So because so many people do it, you sort of realize how this is a not, quote-unquote, normal way that things are done, right? And so if you start questioning it, you're the person who questions it is sort of looked at like, well, what's wrong
you're
with you?
You're the outsider.
You're the outsider, yes. So this is the
Chika, let me see. There's some callers on. I want to see if they have any questions, okay?
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. You're calling from 4747 is the last four digits of your phone. Did you have a question for the author?
No, good morning. I'm just excited to listen to Author Chika because I've read so many of her books, and I'm so happy. Thank
What's
you
your
so
name?
Much, Joy, for having her so we can listen to her, you know, and hear her voice.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to see if someone else has a question, okay? Hold on.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. You're calling from 9746 area, your last four digits. Did you have a question for the author? Good morning. Okay, I guess not. Let's try this other one. You're calling 4638 are the last four digits of your number. Did you have a question for the author? 240 area code.
Oh, no, I just got the number off of Facebook, and I thought I'd hear my sister's voice, that's all.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this issue of witchcraft. That chapter, you have a whole chapter dealing with witchcraft, and I was reading different articles about witchcraft in Africa and the belief, and my skin cringed because a lot of children are being called witches and branded as witches and starved and beaten and having to become homeless. Can you talk to me in the audience more about this issue of witchcraft in Nigerian culture?
So the story that you're referring to is of a woman who sort of gets taken in. She's convinced by a charlatan that the girl who lives with her is a witch and is responsible for everything going wrong in her life. And I think a few years ago, I read an article out of Nigeria about a case, and I think it was in Calabar, where young kids are being accused of being witches and being thrown out of their homes and being sent to pastors who claim that they can exorcise them from witchcraft. And I think that when people are dealing with a whole lot of things, with poverty especially, the kind of desperation that comes with dealing with poverty tends to drive people to believe in things that they ordinarily wouldn't believe in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, so at certain point in history, there have been, you know, so in the U.S., remember, running the witches of Salem,
yes.
And in the UK at certain point, there are always times when human beings have looked for answers, right? Have looked for answers in certain places for things that they don't understand, right? And so for these kids in Calabar, you know, for their parents or for whoever they lived with, the fact that, you know, all their hard work wasn't bringing the fruit that they expected it that they expected the hard work to bring, made them more susceptible, you know, to believe that somehow these innocent children were responsible for them. Because if you can't blame yourself, you have to take the blame onto somebody
Point
else.
Somewhere else.
right? Yeah, of course. So now let me ask you this though.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. What about the laws? What about the government? Nobody steps in, and who protects these children that, you know, are being burned or beaten, you know, oil poured on them, all kinds of things. Who is there to protect them?
Well, the law should be there to protect them, but there's also a lot of NGOs doing the work that the law should do, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that as in every society, there are people who are always above the law. I mean, it's sad, but it's the truth. Right, we had recently a few years ago in the States who committed manslaughter and then ended up going free because his very expensive lawyer managed to convince the judge that he suffered from affluenza, which was that he had a lot of money and did it, and sort of couldn't be bound to the same rules as regular people because his affluence and his wealth meant that he never learned to obey those rules, right? And
mm-hmm. It happens here in America. Yeah. People have money. They get away with stuff.
Yeah, so the affluenza case was an American case. But I think that in every society, you always have people who are somehow above the law for whatever reason, right? But in a society, too, where people are very easily bribable because they're, for many different reasons, including the fact that they're not very well paid, the law doesn't function as well as it should. Right. And so there are NGOs. I think in the case of one of the article I read about the Nigerian kid, he was taken in by Danish woman who started an NGO and who was going around the streets rescuing these children and then bringing them back to her NGO, to the home that she set up, and then sending them to school and cleaning them up. I think one of the things that makes me happy about the Nigerian case is that people are not waiting for the government or the law to step in because they no longer trust them. They no longer trust the law. They no longer trust the government. And so individuals and private initiatives and the NGOs are the ones stepping into that gap that the government and the law should step into and doing the things that the government and the law should do and doing them well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's good because, you know, here in America, we also have children that get abused and mistreated, and as well as migrants who are coming in working for people. Some people lock them in the house, take their passports, all types of things. So it happens all over the globe.
You broke off a bit.
Oh, okay. I was saying that in America, we also have children that get abused and mistreated, and also migrants that come into work.
I can't hear a thing.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now? Maybe she's breaking up.
I've lost you. I'm sorry.
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, I lost you completely.
Can you hear me
now? I didn't hear a single thing for like it. I can hear you now, yes.
Okay. I'm not sure what happened, but we only have a couple of minutes left. But I do want to tell the audience, she does have a lot of love in her books. Everything is not bad. She has a great love story that happens. Okay. Can you hear me now? I'm not sure what's happening. Maybe the system. You know, the internet, it's crazy sometimes. but I do want to thank you for coming on today. I'm going to be giving away copies can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm going to be giving away copies of your book today. So people, keep your eyes peeled. Follow me on Twitter @JoyKeys. Also check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And you can also go to Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. I just want to say again, thank you, Dalu, which means thank you. Can you hear me, Chica, still? I think she can't hear me anymore. But everybody else, thank you again. And I wish you have a great weekend. Please take care of yourself and remember the different tips that were given by the PSA earlier, protecting yourself with the face mask, washing your hands, wiping down things in your home. None of us like this situation, but we do need to try to deal with it. And I just want to tell you, I will have another show coming up at 11:30, talking with Leslie Irby, first Black woman who has a disability, got a pilot license. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.